Let's stand for the scripture reading, which is in your program this morning. It is from Hebrews 12, verses 1 through 4. Let's say these verses together. Please note the repetition of the word endure or endurance in this brief passage. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your own striving against sin. Be seated, please. In some ways, the message this morning is particularly directed to those of you who have taken the vows of membership in our church this morning, and you young people who have really, in a very wonderful way, publicly professed your faith in the Lord. But I think also the applicability to us all is, I trust, going to be evident. I have not gotten to watch much of the Olympics the last 2 weeks. But the bit I have seen has been, as it always is, tremendously invigorating. And like you, probably the most exciting part of seeing the Olympics is that occasional story of an individual whose ability and effort, whose stamina and, yes, endurance, helps them to achieve something that you sense is beyond the achievement of even a gold medal. I suppose each Olympics has its own set of stories, and perhaps each one has your favorite. Mine this time would have to be the example of Dan Jansen. 4 times he has been to the Olympics. 4 times he has been slated to win the 500-meter speed skating event. 4 times he has slipped on the at the outset of the race, and 4 times this world champion has lost. He returned this year clearly for the last time, clearly knowing that it was now or never for him, and he got ready to run this particular race maybe for the last time, and he slipped. And he did not win it. Then, as an afterthought, really, not the event for which he had worked so hard, and not the event for which he had trained, he was also entered into the 1,000-meter speed skating event, a much longer, more difficult event. Well, you know the story. He won it. And in his winning that, he did indeed probably win much more than the gold medal. He won something that demonstrated his own endurance, his ability to withstand incredible, inordinate internal and external pressure. I read an account a week or so ago, right after the race, of what it was like for him to have to wait and face the prospect of these races, and the incredible sense of longing combined with anguish which filled his soul. And you all, I know, could sense the incredible relief as he gathered up his daughter in one arm and carried the American flag in his other hand and took his victory lap after winning the gold in the 1,000 meters. I wonder how often Dan Jensen said, I'm just going to give up. I just can't face the pressure of anticipating yet another race. I just can't get ready for another Olympics. I just can't go on. I don't know about you, but I see in that a wonderful parable of our Christian life. For there are indeed times in our lives, and the author of Hebrews is here very concerned about the times in our Christian lives when we grow weary and faint-hearted. Literally, he is concerned about those whom he describes here who lose their heart. Those who do not or cannot continue to be guided by their deepest convictions about their lives. Certainly for Dan Jensen, he had to muster some of the most profound and deep convictions about all of his life in order to keep on preparing for these races. And there are times in our Christian lives when we must, as it were, dig deep and find out what is really there and what it is that God has really done in our lives, and is it enough to keep going? And oftentimes, Christians seem to lose their way, or to use the words here, lose their hearts, become faint-hearted in their pursuit of Christ and their pursuit of the things of Christ and of their faith. We live in a time of absolutely unparalleled faint-heartedness in the Church of Jesus Christ. I would propose to you that the last generation or so has never been equaled in terms of the faint-heartedness that exists in the church. There is a good Greek word for that. It's a word that comes out not so much out of the New Testament, but out of the classic Greek writers. It is the word asidia. Literally, in English, it would be translated sloth. But it means much more than laziness. It means spiritual inaptness. Spiritual lethargy. Acedia, or spiritual sloth, comes from the notion of losing one's heart, losing one's inner direction, and becoming too concerned about external matters. Being too concerned about worldly things, being too concerned about things material, and not enough absorbed by the things that are internal. One becomes mesmerized by the world and loses one's taste for the spiritual. That's acedia. So there is an absence of zeal for spiritual things that results in the end, a kind of sorrow, the Greeks called it, a sadness. For the things of the world do not give true joy, no matter how much we pursue them. The Greeks knew that, and certainly the New Testament writers knew that, that if you pursue the things of the world and you get them, you will not have the deepest, richest happiness that we can have. This seems to be the danger concerning which the author of the book of Hebrews fears for his readers. That having started so well, they will now begin to falter in their spiritual zeal, and they will fall victim to acedia. He says earlier in chapter 10, "But remember the former days." In other words, he's trying to call them back to the days when they had done better. "When after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who are so treated." So he says, you endured a great deal. And in fact, he goes on in this context to say, "You showed sympathy to prisoners. You accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession, an abiding one." In other words, there was real, tangible, concrete difficulty in these Christians' lives. But they shone like stars in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Therefore, he says, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what has been promised. In other words, he's saying, once you did so well, once you were not filled with acedia or sloth, but now something has happened. And you seem to be weighed down. Literally in chapter 6 of the book of Hebrews, he says, you are sluggish. Have you ever felt that way as a Christian? Of course you have. Sluggish, weighed down, overburdened. Overburdened with things, with the rearrangement of matter. And zeal for spiritual things gets squeezed out of our lives. A friend of mine, reflecting on the death of a much older man named Jordan, who had been a Christian for many years, wrote this. I know this sounds ridiculous coming from a 5-year-old Christian, but sometimes it does get hard to see the finishing line. And sometimes I do wonder if any of it makes any difference. Does that ring a bell with you? I wonder how many times Jordan got tired. And I wonder how he got over it. I need to figure out how to make myself good to go for another 5 years or 50,000 miles. And then maybe I'll need another tune-up. Haven't you felt that way? That you're just about at the end of the warranty and the engine breaks down and that you just don't know if you're going to be able to muster another 5 years or 50,000 miles. The treads are wearing thin. You're tired. So in chapter 2, the author says, pay closer attention to what you heard lest we drift away from it. There's enormous temptation for the faint in heart to withdraw when we see what the Christian life really requires. But John Calvin spoke to that in a very pointed way. Listen to his words. There is no reason for us to seek our discharge from the Lord, whatever service we have performed, because Christ does not have any discharged soldiers except those who have conquered death itself. So we need to ask the question, how can we lean against acedia, spiritual sloth? How can we steadfastly endure? To use the word that is repeated 3 times in this passage. Literally, to endure means to remain without fleeing, to stand one's ground, to hold out in trouble or affliction. It means to stay in the furnace of affliction, knowing that if you are melted there, it is God's doing to mold you in your melted condition into what He would have you be. And many Christians know nothing of this because we have too quickly grown faint-hearted. We have too quickly drawn ourselves away from the fire. And so, despite the fact that we might like to be Olympic athletes, we choose not to endure the difficulty, and therefore we know nothing of the gold either. 4 things. Time is short, and I'm going to be quite brief on each of them, but I want you to just jot these down or remember them out of this passage. I believe they come directly from the text. 4 things that tells us how to endure in the midst of the temptation to faint-heartedness. The first is to remember that life is a race. Verse 1, run the race of endurance that is set before us. The author uses athletic imagery, obviously. Life is a contest. The competitors are down on the floor. They're surrounded by the crowds in the stand. Paul also uses this image in some of his writings. He says, do you not know that those who run a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. Then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. There are all kinds of inferences that we can properly draw from this analogy that life is a race. As Paul puts it, we should run to win. There is an object to our Christian lives. The object of our Christian lives, dear friends, is not to be happy. The object of our Christian lives isn't to just muddle through. The object, ultimately, if you understand this text, is that we would one day be at the right hand of God with Christ. For that's where the text says Jesus is just now in verse 2. And we will one day be with Him there. And as we are with Him there, that is the imperishable prize, the wonderful prize of glory that awaits us. We must not give up that prize in order to walk aimlessly, run aimlessly through this life. When I jog, sometimes my only objective is to make it back to my house without spraining my ankle. And in the jog or the run of life, so often our object is just to get through without getting hurt. Just to get through with enough of the world's goods that we expect at the end of our lives we'll have enough that we can be comfortable. Hey, hear me. That is not a sufficient object of life for God's people. It's not enough. The prize is better. The gold is the right hand of the throne of grace. Don't take your eyes off that prize and put your eyes on some meager little prize along the way. So run the race, therefore, with thoughtfulness and determination. Chrysostom was one of the church fathers. Listen to the way he talked about this passage. Many of you have many times been spectators at the Olympic Games. And not only spectators, but also enthusiastic partisans and admirers of the competitors. You know then that both during the days of the contest and also all night long, the runner thinks of nothing else and has no other care than that he should not disgrace himself when he goes forth. If therefore he who is about to engage in a contest before men uses such great forethought, much more will it befit us to be continually thoughtful and earnest, since our whole life is a contest. Be thoughtful about your Christian life. Be earnest about it. Racing is not easy. It takes enormous mental discipline to live this life the way God intends us to. Do not be the kind of Christian who walks around with your umbilical cord hanging out looking for some place to plug it in every day. Be one who trains yourself for the race, for the prize. That leads on quickly to the second point. Put aside whatever hinders you in this race. Put aside whatever hinders you. Verse 1, let us also lay aside every encumbrance. Encumbrance literally means weight. Whatever slows us down, whatever holds us back, whatever feeds our spiritual laziness. When training for a big marathon race, the runner loses weight. When it's time for the race, he takes off all of the sweat clothes, the warm-up suits that would encumber him. We are to disencumber ourselves from anything that keeps us from going for that prize. Now, let me give you an illustration that may, I hope it causes you to think. I know a man, an older man, long retired, who has a hobby. It's stamp collecting. For years, he has collected stamps. He has one of the finest stamp collections probably in the country. He came to a place in his life a few years ago, 10 or more years into his retirement, when he said, I need to give up stamp collecting for a while. And when asked why, he said, because it's taking too much of my mental, emotional energy. And I need to give that mental and emotional energy to Christ and His kingdom. I said to this man, friend, you are 75 years old. If you want to collect stamps, you go ahead and collect stamps. He said, no, Skip. I need to pursue Christ. And at 75 years old, he went down to the jail every two or three times a week to witness to prisoners. And he was involved in all kinds of ministry because he didn't want any encumbrance to keep him from running the race. And specifically, the encumbrance that we must watch out for is the sin that so easily entangles us. And literally, that means we should look for those particular sins which might entangle us, meaning you. What sin will entangle you? What is the particular way in which the devil, the world, and the flesh is working on you to keep you from running the race? Whatever that is, that's the encumbrance you need to deal with. Third, look at those who surround you. Again, verse 1, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses. And the author certainly is referring to the Hebrews 11 Hall of Fame of the Faithful that precedes this passage. In Hebrews chapter 11, go home and read it this afternoon, there is a listing of Old Testament saints who are faithful in their endurance. But no doubt he's also talking about veterans of faith in every age. They're called witnesses, not because they're spectators watching us run our races, but because they are witnesses to the Lord who helped them run effectively. So it's not so much that they are watching us. That's not the author's meaning. It's rather we who are to watch them as they watch Christ. And we are to learn from them. That's why spiritual biography is so important. That's why reading the Bible, reading the accounts of the faith of these Old Testament warriors is so important. That's why reading the sorts of material that it... Don't read Christian junk. And there's so much of it out there. Read biography. I wish for every how-to Christian book, how to do this, how to get my life together, how to have a better quiet time. Folks, it's froth. It won't last. It's in somebody else's clever idea. Instead, read the way Hudson Taylor conducted his spiritual life. Read the way John Wesley thought and prayed and meditated over the things of God. Read of some of the great saints of the Christian church, and there will be all the lessons you'll need. All the how-tos will be there. Watch the saints watching Christ. And especially watch the saints watching Christ as they suffer for Him. For half or more of those saints listed in Hebrews chapter 11 are those who endured all kinds of awful things because they named the name of Christ. And as you do, I sometimes watch certain people, maybe the elders of the church, maybe a particular person, godly lady. And I wonder, how are they enduring? And among the most sensitive people I watch, I sense this, a question. Will I endure to the end? Will I make it? The most sensitive have always asked that question. They actually fear that something may happen to distract them from Christ. They actually fear that, in fact, sloth, acedia, will begin to overtake them. They fear that their mind may go in old age and they may curse Christ. They fear that. And they pray against it. But the most wonderful thing about those saints is that they know in the end that the question, will I endure to the end, is not the right question. The right question is that Jesus Christ endured to the end. And therefore, as I look to Him, and therefore as I consider Him, I gain the grace and strength for my endurance. And that is the fourth point. Look to the one who has already won the race. Verse 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of God. Surely there is to be an encouragement from the host of witnesses, but surely the supreme model is the one who has run the race of endurance completely. In his earthly life, Jesus was the embodiment of steadfast endurance. He was faithful to God when others dropped out. He was obedient to God when others took easier paths. He was dependent upon God when others sought to make it in their own strength. Jesus endured through many temptations and afflictions. Jesus knew full well what his race meant. It didn't mean happiness. It meant arrest and false accusation and extremes of suffering. He knew the cross meant shame. He knew the cross was a place of disgraceful public execution, a punishment for the worst of criminals. The cross meant that Christ plumbed the depths of human wickedness and evil and shame and humiliation. It meant that no person, no matter how sinful, is ever beyond the reach of Christ. But the cross that meant shame for Christ means grace for us. Grace to endure. For you see, Jesus Christ is more than just an example. He's not just the one who modeled steadfast endurance. He gives us grace to endure as we look at Him. That's why the author of Hebrews says earlier on in this epistle these wonderful words: since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help in time of need. Grace has been given to us because Jesus has taken upon himself all of our temptations and all of our weaknesses. He has carried them together with our sins to the cross. And there he overcame by the endurance of the cross all of the temptations and all of the bitternesses of death, hell, and destruction. And now he has sat down at the right hand of God the Father, from whence place he gives you grace to endure the weaknesses and the frailties and the trials and the struggles of your life, so that you will one day be with him there. Consider him. Consider him who endured such hostility against sinners. Consider him who, unlike us, has not had to shed his blood. Consider him whose bloody endurance is the power you need for your endurance. Consider him who gives you grace in your weakness, who gives you grace in your temptation, even the temptation to give up, to be faint-hearted, not to endure. And as you consider him, his grace becomes your strength, and you grow in your ability to endure. Consider him who, for the joy set before him of your salvation, endured the cross, accepted the shame, and has now sat down at the throne of God. Consider him. Consider him. Consider him. And remember, as Paul puts it in one of his letters to a young, timid Timothy, in danger of faint-heartedness, if we endure with him, we will reign with him. Consider him. Consider him. Consider him.